Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We have top men working on it right now.
Who?
Top men.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes and those infographics of cows that show you where all the different types of meat come from. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
I thought the lizards lived underground.
No. See, this is the latest David Icke book. See,
we go for it. Go for it.
This is Conspirathon.
Go for it.
Brett's so excited.
Do it.
In every situation, it's always aliens.
Ghosts and Satan. Finally, Alex Jones shows up.
And are the real lizard people?
Yes, kind of. And that's why the Nazis
want to go
in
Antarctica. Not lizardy? In what way are they lizardy?
The British are the troublemakers of history, for sure.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Yes, wow.
Well, how do we get to Super Shekinah? Hi, everybody. This is Brett. Today is August 4th. Welcome back to School Sucks. This is Conspirathon, and this is a whip. All right. So most of today's discussion is built around a question that I ask right at the beginning. How far is each one of us willing to go with what we believe? One of us will go all the way to New York City. Another one of us will go all the way to Egypt. And the remaining participant in this discussion is willing to leave the planet. Whoa. All that will be explained very soon. And, you know, our number one priority in this whole discussion was certainly to have fun, but I hope we're able to provide some meaningful new ways to think about these explorations and the discussions that often follow. I don't like having to use words like belief. I don't like having to use phrases like conspiracy theory. And I'm certainly open to suggestions as to how this discussion could have been more meaningful or could have been more educational. We are skimming the surface of a lot of potential explorations in these shows, and if we touch on anything that you'd like to hear discussed more in depth, let me know about that too. But before we get to that, I just want to let everybody know that tomorrow, August 5th, is the 6th anniversary of the School Sucks Project, really the School Sucks Podcast. We released our first episode on August 5th, 2009, and I wanted to commemorate that with a special live show, hopefully a listener participation live show. We're going to be streaming at schoolsucksproject.com/live. We're going to have some special guests, and I would love your participation. 843-JOIN-SSP is how to get in touch with us. We'll also have a chat. We'll read your little chats. You can chat with each other, make friends in the chat. So check that out if you're around tomorrow night. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. Here we go. Here's part two.
That was a very reasonable and measured, thoughtful conversation that we had.
Yeah, I thought so.
In the first segment, but now I think it's time. What do you want to say?
It's time to go wheels off.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. But we all talked about coming from different places, and you were saying that you, Stephanie, were the skeptic here.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what would you say is the most outlandish thing you'd be willing to lend credence to?
I think that it may be true that the Egyptians didn't build the pyramids, that they found them, that another civilization built them earlier, and the Egyptians, like, found them.
They squatted.
Squatted, yeah. Now, because they're mentioned in Sumerian texts. The pyramids are referenced in older texts.
What?
Like, from before they were built. Supposedly from Sumerian, but maybe the dating is off on those. It's possible. So, yeah, it doesn't fit that there is no, like, writing about, like, how they were constructed, a lot of the pyramids, and what the purpose of, like, some of those chambers were for. I won't really speculate on like what they were for, but I'm not sure that the tomb for the kings built by slaves theory necessarily fits. And I'd be open to the fact that there's like a wall of history and before it, we don't really know what happened. There could have been advanced civilizations, humans, not aliens. So I guess like advanced human civilizations older than 10 to 12,000 years ago.
Now, the conspiracy here would be that this is hidden.
Yeah, I guess that it's hidden or just that it doesn't agree with like mainstream archaeology.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I think there would be some people who might say, well, they didn't build them themselves. They had help from aliens, or that this knowledge couldn't have been attained by humans. It was passed on by some other advanced civilization that was extraterrestrial. And I'm not saying that. But when we start talking about things being older than like 10 to 12,000 years and built by advanced civilizations, some people immediately go to aliens. And I'm not going there, but I'm just saying there might be older stuff out there built by humans.
For the audio listeners, you did gesture somewhat forcefully in Brian's direction. When you said,
I don't think Brian goes to aliens either, but we've watched some of the ancient aliens stuff together. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Like, obviously a lot of it is just like BS, but
they go right to aliens.
In every situation, it's always aliens.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's a huge stretch.
Yeah. I may have helped convince Stephanie of some of these ideas. So we'll just put it that way.
So are you familiar with like Graham Hancock and
yeah,
all that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and I think they've even found some things that don't fit the timeline as far as
Göbekli Tepe.
Yeah, mm-hmm. sites.
Yeah.
And they think Göbekli Tepe is what, 13,000
at least
years
14,
old.
Yeah.
So we're talking 8,000 years before the pyramids.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what do you know about that site? Because I know they're uncovering it, and they say it's fairly advanced and spread out.
It was like a whole buried city, as I understand it, just caves and caverns, underground kind of city.
Yeah, so as far as its advancement, I mean, we're not talking about like it's a city where people somehow had nuclear power or anything like that, but they definitely, the design is pretty advanced.
That's Mohenjo-Daro.
Right, yeah. That's a whole other ballgame. But the interesting thing with it is that it seems to have been purposefully buried. Like, it's not something that got lost to time. It's something that was, like, somebody wanted it to not be found.
Interesting.
And so they covered
it up. Or wanted it to be preserved, maybe.
Yeah, or wanted to preserve it, maybe. But, I mean, not that it got preserved that well. Some of the, you know, some of the more larger structures around the city where there's, like, animal, you know, stonework being done is decently damaged. So they might have failed in that regard. But regardless, the evidence seems to point to the fact that it was buried by somebody.
And there's no theories as to who or specifically why. It's all probably just speculation. I don't even know how you would develop a coherent theory about that.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And this is where, you know, conspiracy theorists, this is their ball field.
We'll take it from here.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's so easy to seem really intelligent or be, you know, make an entire theory around holes in something else as compared to trying to maybe falsify your own claims. But, I mean, but there are genuine holes in a lot of archaeological theory. I mean, you have, there's the bull. There's this bowl in, like, you know, a pottery in South America that has cuneiform on it, which is Sumerian writing. That can't be there. Like that, there's no way that there should be cuneiform in you know, in South America and Peru. And so, you know, what does a mainstream archaeology say? They just don't. They just ignore it. That's all you can do. So I think, you know, a lot of times when you run into things like Göbekli Tepe and others, that's about what they do, is they just have to ignore it.
Denial. So Hancock's talked about this too, like the similarity of structures in different parts of the world and the similarity of artifacts in different parts of the world doesn't seem to make any sense. It's interesting to think about how many blind spots there might be in this study.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's frustrating to me as a former history teacher and reading through the textbooks is history is taught with a certainty and a finality, mm-hmm. the same way math or science is taught.
Right.
And it doesn't really, I don't remember like graduating from high school and feeling like there was an exploration of history for me to do.
on my own. You know, like it's settled, it's known. And that's really not the case, especially when, you know, I got to college and I talked about this in the last part of the show about these different viewpoints. These different lenses is the term I usually use for looking at history, you know, the people's lens versus the top-down great man lens. And then you start to see there's all these different ways to tell these stories and all these different vantage points to tell these stories.
Yeah, very especially when you get away from great man theory.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a kind whole of, new world.
You're really robbed of a lot of learning opportunities because
of that. So many of these archaeologists, too, like it's totally true that they project their own cultural viewpoints and their own ideas onto the things that they find. Like, for instance, a lot of anthropologists will refer to, you know, different like relationship arrangements among tribes as marriage when it's really not marriage in the Western Judeo-Christian kind of sense, but they call it marriage. Or like in Pompeii when they uncovered, you know, this explosion and there were erotic frescoes on the walls and like British archaeologists painted over them because they didn't want to like admit that there were people having sex and it was on the walls.
Yeah, that's a real problem because, you know, I think a lot of people would ask, well, what, you think there's some kind of grand cover up? Well, in some cases there really are.
It was just because that was their viewpoint on the world.
Right.
Like that. They saw something that didn't fit with what they understood or that what they were comfortable with, and they ignored it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they literally did cover it up. They put plaster right over these frescoes, you know, to keep people from seeing it. So, yeah, it's a cover up.
Well, they were top men.
Top men. That's right.
Top men.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but right. It's definitely a reflection of their own attitudes and platitudes.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm just saying there's biases in the reporting of history.
Oh, absolutely.
In archaeology, in historical texts, accounts of stuff that happened. There's even like the Library of Alexandria is something that that's kind of a pet topic of Brian's that we talk about a lot,
sure.
Where there was a history of the world going back 100,000 years by Berossus, this Greek historian, and it got burned in the Library of Alexandria.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have like, we have little scraps of it left.
We only have like the title page that says a history of the world going back 100,000 years.
Right.
And the rest of it's gone.
Right. Which lends a bit of credibility to what you're describing in that, you know, there was a human history that goes back 100,000 years. I mean, did Berossus just make it up? Maybe, but like, why go back 100,000 years?
Could have been fiction.
Why not just do what the Jews did and start at 6,000, you know, or at that time it would be 4,000. But I think there is some legitimate information probably there.
Thomas Cahill wrote an interesting book called How the Irish Saved Civilization.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And he talks about these groups of monks going and rescuing basically all of Western knowledge at the fall of the Roman Empire, bringing it back to Ireland and translating it before it was destroyed by, you know, barbarians or just complete chaos.
Right.
And if you think about that being true, and you think about the period usually referred to as the Dark Ages, where the church pretty much has control over knowledge and information, the entire history of the world could have been rewritten to anything.
Yeah.
You know? And it almost makes sense why they would have kept the Greeks in there, because a lot of the Catholic teachings used Aristotelian logic in the Middle Ages. But there's a lot of interesting questions. And of course, it's all just this, you know, unfortunately, go nowhere exercise.
Yeah. What is it going
to
do?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's certainly interesting to think about. Yeah. I was really, it was one of the things that motivated me to, I think, pursue history from a different angle, realizing through the experience that I had in college, even though I had to unlearn a lot of what was learned there, just how many opportunities are stolen from us. In schooling, to really, you know, take ownership of this exploration. And the resources today are so superior to what they were when I was discovering this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Stephanie, I don't know if I'd call that a conspiracy. I'd call that a slam dunk. The Egyptians didn't build the pyramids. You know, this is an interesting thing, too. I must have told this story before. Pretty much how I got into everything was I was teaching history, and I was kind of like into, all right, we were lied to by this mainstream. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In 2004, I was dating this girl, and she had this uncle, and he came up he lived like down by the city, and we were in upstate New York, and he came up, and he was like, so what do you do? He was an electrician. He worked on Wall Street. He was a real asshole. But we had some good conversations. I'm like, I'm a teacher. He goes, oh yeah? His name was also Jimmy, just like my friend who wanted to privatize the fire department. Interestingly. So he said, I bet you didn't know Egyptians didn't build the pyramids. I was like, no, I thought they did. This was aliens. Just with like so much conviction and almost like not conviction or passion, just like, how do you not know this? Think about it, man.
Yep.
And then he rattles off like 10 facts from some episode of Coast to Coast with George Norrie or Art Bell.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And I go, that can't be true. Not like the whole thing, but like the pyramids are at this specific point in longitude and latitude,
right,
and they have these portals.
Orion.
These portals, and then the each length portals. Is this many feet, and even though they wouldn't have known what a foot was,
right?
You know, but the number of feet is representative of some astrological thing. So I said, oh, okay, all right. Well, what's this show in Coast to Coast? And that was how it started for me. That was my awakening. And then after listening to stories about ghosts and Satan, finally Alex Jones shows up in like 2005 for this 9/11 debate with Peter Lance, who was an investigative journalist, and two other guys hosted by George Norrie. And from there, I start getting into Alex Jones. And from there, I get into 9/11. And from there, I say, okay, well, what more 9/11-y things can I find on iTunes? And that was actually how I found my friend Rich. Mm. And he used to do a show called 9/11 Synchronicity. And then I found Free Talk Live. And I was off. And then they were like, shit all over every conspiracy theory from 9/11 to chemtrails. And I was like, yeah, conspiracy theories are stupid. These guys know what they're talking about.
So during that time when you were learning, when you were listening to Alex Jones and like all that stuff at Coast to Coast, how did that affect your teaching?
Okay, well, this was in 2004. I had just started, it screwed it up big time.
Yeah.
So I had a narrative.
Alex Jones ruined everything.
I had to teach American history and I had to teach world history. So there wasn't much Alex Jones type stuff that I could interject into that. Uh-huh. But I think the second year that I taught history in 2005, I added a thing on the Federal Reserve. I expanded my whole founding of America thing to include like a big section on the Freemasons and the Illuminati.
Boy. Yeah.
You know?
Whoa.
The Weisenhop there.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And how all these guys were, George Washington was a Freemason, and that all got into it. Secret societies. We watched a documentary about the moon.
Oh,
landing, maybe not being such a real thing. And I was like, here, kids, I just want to show you something and just, what do you think? It wasn't like,
impressionable young minds. I just like to toss this upon.
I believe this. And then I remember.
I'm picturing like the kid coming home and the mom's like, so Johnny, what did you learn at school today? And Johnny's like, we learned that the moon landing was fake.
Yeah. In the movie Interstellar, that's actually true in the future. That's what they teach in school.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, in Interstellar, there's a part where he goes to work, like the, was it McConaughey? McConaughey's character goes with his daughter to school, and they're having kind of a parent-teacher conference kind of thing. And he's like, no, we went to the moon. And the teacher is saying, no, you don't understand. We know that it was all just a lie to do whatever.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I forgot that.
And so you were just predicting the future.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I really didn't. I was like, this is pretty far-fetched, but this is just interesting. And I talked about all these different theories of how human beings came to be, because that was a big theme on Coast to Coast.
Yeah.
So one of the theories was de-evolution. Oh, we did genetic engineering. We did the Anunnaki.
Yeah.
Humans engineered to mine gold. And I'm just saying, look, all I said is like what most people, and I feel like I was thoughtful about it. As completely unthoughtful as I was then compared to now, I like to think, I was still like trying to be careful about what I was doing. So the de-evolution theory that we are actually evolving back down from something more advanced was one that I liked and kind of fits with the whole.
Yeah.
Possibly superior technologically advanced, or at least intellectually advanced civilization in the past. And we even did some like Native American creation myths. But I said, look, you get this either or evolution or creation. So here's all the things that I can think of that have been discussed. And we did like 10 of them, I think.
Wow, interesting.
And the kids found that really interesting. So I think that in some ways my teaching was enhanced by this because all I wanted to do, I knew it didn't matter what they walked out of there knowing, right? They were never going to use dates or names or needing to know what mercantilism is. But were they interested in learning? And were they interested in learning about history and politics and government?
Well, I think some of those stories have to instill a real sense of wonder. I mean, suddenly, everything's exciting again because there's possibilities.
Well, somebody was just asking me, what's your favorite story to tell? And it was clearly the story of Squanto, the Native American. Mm-hmm. Do you guys know this story? So in the myth, the pilgrims come, and then there's this divine intervention or this blessing of this man named Squanto who's there waiting to help them. And he speaks English. How convenient. And he's got endless amounts of time and knowledge
and
to devote to that. And they come to a place where corn is already growing, but he seems to be like one of the only people around. And how magical a story, that these
he's
people.
Like Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. These people who came here for religious freedom just so happen land on the site of the world's freest country in the future. How special. So Squanto was real. And what's omitted from the story is like everything interesting about him. Somewhere between 1600 and 1605, he was kidnapped by British fishermen. And they took him to England, where they trained him as an interpreter.
Wow.
Eventually, he industriously worked his way back, I think getting on another.
Yeah, he was abducted by aliens.
Pretty much.
Legal aliens.
Pretty much.
Legal
so,
aliens.
So he works his way back to New England on some other expedition, and before he can get back to the Cape Cod, Mass Bay area, he's kidnapped again.
Ugh, poor and Squanto.
He's taken by this kind of rogue member of John Smith's crew to Spain to be sold into slavery, but then he's rescued by a group of priests who bring him back to Britain again. So he had made it back almost to his home. Then he's taken back to Europe. So he gets on it. When he gets back to England, he meets some other ship captain. I forget who the guy was exactly. And he gets on a voyage to go to Newfoundland and where he's going to work his way down back to home. In Newfoundland, the person who's in charge of the expedition says, no, you have to go back to Europe. So they won't let him leave and just kind of wander. So he goes back to Europe. And finally, like 1619, he figures out a way to get back to do this coastal exploration with the same crew that had kidnapped him and sent him to Spain.
Oh, my God.
Not the same guys, but the same ship captain, John Smith, right? Different crew, but basically the same situation he had been in when he was taken. He gets back around 1620 to the Mass Bay area and finds that everyone he's ever known had died of smallpox.
Oh. Wow.
How heartbreaking.
I know. So,
and he was immune to it because he'd been exposed to these white people?
That is probably what's most likely.
Oh, my gosh.
Or he missed the epidemic because he was in Europe. Yeah. He was very lucky to have survived because he was exposed. I mean, you take a Native American and bring them to Europe?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And like on a ship with malnutrition and stuff? Like, wow.
So if this story is true, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Right.
So the pilgrims show up and he's like, fuck it. I'll help these people. I'm lonely. And that was not really an awesome origin story to expose the fact that the British had actually been here screwing things up since the 1580s.
Right.
Kidnapping people, maybe doing some grave digging, getting lost, being stupid. You know, I'm kind of very anti-British thing. I'm sorry to our listeners in England. It's not you who are alive today in England. It's just the British are the troublemakers of history for sure.
And colonialism, it just ruins everything.
It does. But that story sucks. It's like, oh man, these people came here, Walter Raleigh, Sir Francis Drake, and they'd drop people off and they'd disappear, or they'd eat each other, and they'd bring more people back, and they'd kidnap some people and bring them back, and it was a real shit show. No, you start with a group of people seeking religious freedom, land on a rock,
Yeah.
A rock. Solid.
Solid as a rock.
Foundation.
Yeah, foundation. Exactly. And they even found a rock somewhere in like the harbor that, or the what's that called? The bay. It's like, this is the rock.
Oh, there's a plaque. I used to live around there.
Yeah.
There's Plymouth Rock.
Yeah, so they made up a rock.
Stand on it.
That the boat hit. And it's like, how did they not see this? It's like, I mean, maybe it looked different then, but it's just,
it's amazing.
You could totally not hit that.
Yeah.
They actually landed in Provincetown, the site of the future gayest town, place in the country.
That's the future.
Yeah. And the conservatives might not have liked it if that was the actual. They didn't hit anything, but they ran aground there.
Yeah.
So, and then they sent expedition ships out to scout the area, and they said, holy wow, you know, or they didn't swear because they were Puritans, but they said, good heavens. There's, you know, lots of, like, the land was cut under. There were crop lines and stuff. I don't know what actually would have been growing if people had been dead for a couple of years, but there would have been food. And they said, we are blessed.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing, like, especially with The Rock, as humorous as it is. I mean, the importance of narrative in a lot of this stuff and a lot of historical context. I mean, so many things are, you know, so many stories have to start with some rock somewhere. Like, it's either the cornerstone of the temple, or it's where, you know, like the Dome of the Rock for Islam. And I think it does. They like to run with this kind of symbol. And this is an important thing in conspiracy theories, is the symbology.
Yeah.
You know, and The Rock is just that. It is a foundation. It's the beginning of a story. It's what you build everything upon afterwards. Every Abrahamic religion is based upon a literal rock. I mean, that's like, you know, at least from the get-go, you know, I mean, because Abraham's story kind of starts with that, or at least his real fealty to God. And so I'm not shocked, you know, that the idea that, oh, there's this, you know, Plymouth Rock is somehow this construct to create the great American story, quote unquote.
Does Christianity have a rock?
Oh, it's Abrahamic. And also, I mean,
Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah, Jesus is, well, I mean, there's plenty of verses.
That's a rock.
Yeah. there's verses also that call, you know, Jesus like the rock of Israel.
Yeah. Okay. All
so,
right.
So it's a very important
part of the
narrative.
There's verses that call him the Rock 93.3.
There might be. You know, Brad, I'm dying to know, like, what, how far are you willing to admit here? What's your base theory, the theory that you're willing to go farthest with?
Well, I mean, I would work in a progression like JFK. That's easy one. 9/11. I'll go that far.
But which version of 9/11?
Not a version that's easily explainable. See, this is the problem. There's no really coherent way to explain it, which makes some people say that's not a good theory. But there is a network that involves Wall Street, security, intelligence that were all a part of it. Mm. And you didn't need thousands of people. It just needed certain people in the right places to make it happen. Hmm. And I think it incorporates a lot of things that have been incorporated in other conspiracy theories. There's a video that you could watch. It's called 9/11 Conspiracy Solved.
And there's always a video.
It's 45 minutes. Or you can listen to Richard Grove's...
It's a pretty tough sell with me, man. Richard, I'd rather hear from you.
Richard Grove's Project Constellation, which is about 2 hours. But people have this caricature of it, that it was like both houses of Congress voting on it in a joint session with the president presiding. I don't think any of them knew. When we were talking in the car, it came up in our conversation in the car. Jacob Hornberger wrote a book about JFK and said the CIA has run, you know,
run
the country's
government since JFK was assassinated.
Yeah. I mean, why leave it to chance? You know, it'd be silly for them not to if they can. And I don't think it's that black and white, but I think there is very much a, you know, secret government in this country.
So all these companies, these private firms, or like pseudo-private because they're all in bed with the government, but like all these companies had an incentive to pull something like this off because they would get government contracts if there was a war?
Well, the incentives are endless. And part of what it was is there's something called the Hammer Fund.
September 1991, shortly after the end of the Cold War, a cabal of elite bankers and intelligence spooks led by George H.W. Bush financed a $240 billion covert operations war chest through the purchase of 10-year securities that, as it happened, were scheduled to come due on September 12, 2001. Project Hammer was undoubtedly used for a wide variety of illicit intelligence operations, but mainly it was used to finance a covert economic operation against the collapsing Soviet Union, whereby unknown Western investors bought up much of the Soviet industry with a focus on oil and gas, crashing the Russian economy, looting its central bank, orchestrating what became known as the Great Ruble Scam, and a wide variety of other clandestine, state-assisted operations designed to thoroughly prevent Russia from ever contesting the U.S. as a world superpower, while in the process lining the pockets of these economic hitmen who swooped in to devour the collapsing Russian economy after the fall of the Soviet Union. A spectacular investment for all, at least until money laundering investigations began tracing all the money, or when the 10-year deadline came up and the securities became due and began the routine process of authenticity and ownership checks. Evidence shows that several federal and private investigations had already stumbled upon the Hammer Fund and were compiling evidence on it up until the 9/11 attacks. These included the Office of Naval Intelligence, or ONI, which was moved to the outer E-ring of the recently renovated section of the Pentagon that was targeted and destroyed on 9/11. According to E.P. Heidner, the ONI had been investigating crimes associated with the plundering of Russia. 39 out of the 40 people who worked in those offices were killed on 9/11, including the entire chain of command. The Pentagon's financial accounting offices in that same wing were also an obvious target, as were the passengers on board Flight 77, many of whom coincidentally held top-secret clearances and were connected with Pentagon black operations. Agents of the Office of Naval Intelligence had also been investigating financial transactions which were linked to securities being managed by those securities dealers in the World Trade Center that were also targeted. 31% of the 125 fatalities in the Pentagon were from the Naval Command Center that housed the Office of Naval Intelligence. 41% of the fatalities in the Twin Towers came from two companies that managed U.S. government securities, Cantor Fitzgerald and Eurobrokers. There were three major security brokers in the World Trade Center, Cantor Fitzgerald, Eurobrokers, and Garbin Intercapital. At 8:46 on the morning of September 11th, Flight 11 flew directly into Martian McLennan's secure computer room in the North Tower, right below the floor on which Cantor Fitzgerald was situated. Cantor Fitzgerald was the largest security dealer in the U.S. Shortly after that, a massive explosion went off just under the FBI offices in the North Tower on the 23rd floor. Fires were reported on the 22nd floor at 8:47. There were also explosions and subsequent fires reported at Garbin Intercapital on the 25th floor and in the basement of Tower 1 as well. Shortly thereafter, at 9:03, Flight 175 hit the South Tower right below the floors on which Eurobrokers was situated. In all three cases, the explosive, fiery destruction consumed the offices in the several floors above, destroying files and trapping victims inside. In the midst of all this, Building 6 was destroyed by an explosion that took place before either tower fell. This secondary explosion took out a portion of the building which just happened to include the El Dorado Task Force's offices. The El Dorado Task Force was an interagency money laundering watchdog group responsible for coordinating all major money laundering investigations in the U.S. In the immediate aftermath of September 11th, these groups would be redirected to investigate terrorist financing. Building 6 was located directly between the North Tower and World Trade Center Building 7. While large portions of World Trade Center 6 were gutted by explosions and later by falling debris from the North Tower, the building itself did not suffer a global symmetric collapse at near freefall acceleration as did Buildings 1, 2, and 7. FEMA photographer and 9/11 whistleblower Kurt Sonnenfeld took some interesting pictures of the U.S. Customs vault in the basement of World Trade Center 6, which was found completely empty and left with the door wide open. All of its contents appear to have been looted during the attacks. There is also evidence that gold was being looted from the vaults beneath World Trade Center 4. There were several early reports of a 10-wheel truck packed with stolen bullion caught fleeing World Trade Center 5 when the vehicle had become stuck on a collapsed ceiling brace, forcing the driver to flee the scene. Many researchers have stumbled across one or two of these anomalies from time to time, the empty vaults, the secondary explosions, the fireproofing upgrades on the exact floors coinciding with failure and impact in the towers, the suspicious power downs and evacuation drills, the World Trade Center tenants and security firms like AIG, Martian McLennan, and Kroll, and their close ties with the intelligence community, etc., etc. These anomalies are not unrelated, but nevertheless became lost inside the chaos of that September morn, the aftermath, and subsequent cover-ups. Okay, so what does all this mean? Overall, a critical mass of brokers from the major government security brokerages in the Twin Towers had to be eliminated to create chaos in the government securities market. A situation needed to be created wherein $240 billion of covert securities could be electronically cleared without anyone asking questions, which happened when the Federal Reserve declared an emergency and invoked its emergency powers that very afternoon. On September 14th, the Securities and Exchange Commission declared a national emergency and for the first time in U.S. history invoked its emergency powers under the Securities Exchange Act Section 12K and eased regulatory restrictions for clearing and settling security trades for the next 15 days. These changes would have allowed the estimated $240 billion in covert government securities to be cleared upon maturity without the standard regulatory controls around identification of ownership. The towers needed to be demolished to create a big enough mess that the illicit activities taking place behind the scenes that morning could be hidden in the confusion of that day. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about who did it and how. 9/11 whistleblower Richard Andrew Grove was a software salesperson for a company called Silverstream. Silverstream's technology was on the cutting edge of internet solutions, offering software to web-enable the critical business functions of Fortune 500 companies, basically integrating and making available on the web the disparate legacy applications and mainframes while simultaneously streamlining workflow and traditional paper processes, with an end result being a lower cost of operation and more efficient transactions. Silverstream had built internet transactional and trading platforms for Merrill Lynch, Deutsche Bank, Bankers Trust, Alex Brown, and Morgan Stanley, to name a few. Leading up to 9/11, Silverstream was designing specialized accounting software for a major client, Marsh & McLennan. Marsh is the world's largest insurance brokerage and was located right below Cantor Fitzgerald in the North Tower. Approximately 295 Marsh employees were murdered that morning along with other innocent victims and employees who either knew too much or too little about their chosen work environment. But most importantly, Silverstream provided a specific type of connectivity that was used to link AIG and Marsh & McLennan, the first two commercial companies on the planet to employ this type of transaction. What then were Marsh and AIG doing, and why did they need to leverage technologies that no other commercial entity on the face of the earth needed to use to conduct business? The recovered hard drives from the World Trade Center, combined with Richard Grove's testimony, give us some intriguing clues. Grove discovered that Silverstream was overbilling Marsh to the tune of $7 million extra dollars for fictitious and unneeded hardware. He also became aware of an exploitable flaw in the accounting software that had been sold to a variety of Marsh's clients and partners. When he brought this up to his superiors at Silverstream and others at Marsh, he was told to keep quiet and not to worry about it. But other friends of his at Marsh were also getting concerned and began documenting what was going on and raising concerns within the company. At last, they were finally granted a hearing with one of Marsh's high-ranking executives and were told to bring all their evidence to a hearing scheduled for 8:30 a.m. on September 11, 2001, on the 93rd floor. The high-ranking member of Marsh, who Grove did not name, would participate via teleconference from the safety of his home, while Marsh employees and potential whistleblowers, Gary Lasko, Catherine Lee, Ken Rice, Richard Bruhard, and John Ultzhofer would die in the meeting room in the North Tower with all their evidence when American Airlines Flight 11 would impact that very section of the building.
So is this in any way related to Donald Rumsfeld that said that there's $2.5 trillion missing from budgets? Like he said that the day before or something like that. Do you know about that?
Yeah, that was the day before.
Yeah.
It is related.
Okay.
The Black Eagle Trust Fund.
I love the names for these things. I mean, you could almost go with the, like, start with a cool title and then fill the rest in later.
That's how you do business.
The Hammer Project, between 1989 and 1991, $240 billion to fund covert operations funded with government securities. And it was being investigated when 9/11 happened. It was supposed to mature. It was 10 years, so it was supposed to mature in 2001. So 9/11, considering the target was supposed to create this chaos in the securities market,
mm-hmm.
right? So there could be this pullout without anybody really noticing.
Nah.
And the Fed came, and I forget what they did, but they basically like level playing field. What was the term for this Jewish 7 year?
The Shemitah.
It would have been the Shemitah of 2001.
Well, I see. Some people would say it was.
Oh, that's right. Some people
that it literally was say it was.
Okay, let me get this straight. Okay. So some people wanted to create confusion in the securities market so that this fund of $250 billion could
basically
withdrawn.
Disappear. Yeah.
And then where would it go?
It was set up for use in covert operations, but it would basically be heisted. It would basically disappear by powerful people in these organizations, Bush included.
Okay, so they did
Senior.
It for money.
Essentially, that it was done for money. But that was just one motive. I mean, all the geostrategic motives still stand.
Explain those.
9/11 is licensed, and the war on terror that follows is licensed to do anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the world, anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is effectively like the plot to Swordfish, right?
What do you mean?
Swordfish,
where like the whole thing is John Travolta's character is trying to, there's like these funds that have been set aside for Black Ops, and he's tasked with protecting America at all costs.
Yeah.
And as Black Ops. And so he wants to get him and a senator are working together to create a situation where they can take all of that money. You know, this billions of dollars that's set aside for Black Ops that no one else knows about in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he can do that, and then he can go on and take on terrorists. I mean, that's literally the plot of Swordfish. So I guess, is it kind of that sort of?
Yeah, it's basically a sleight of hand.
Yeah.
It's to create this internal chaos in the United States or the world securities market so $240 billion can be cleared. Mm-hmm. You know, and then on September 11th, the Federal Reserve says they need to, you know, exercise executive powers. On a few days later, the SEC says the same thing, that this is this special situation. I think they did a 15-day moratorium on securities trading after 9/11.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what people have said is that what you see on TV is basically distraction from a far more advanced and complex operation.
Yeah.
I don't think no matter what the truth is, I don't think there's a nice and neat. I mean, they traced funding of two of the terrorists to Bandar El, the Saudi prince that had like that cozy relationship with the Bushes,
mm-hmm.
like Prince Bandar. They called him Bandar Bush. And Michael Moore talked about him in Fahrenheit 9/11.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but then there's also this interesting British connection. Like that there was British intelligence, there was Pakistani intelligence, there was American intelligence. Getting to the truth, is that all one theory of what happened? And then like even the networks involved in, you know, the actual events around the Twin Towers from the, you know, Securicom and Kroll Associates and these people who are supposedly handling security on the site. There's just a lot of really, really odd coincidences.
Yeah.
When you look at the complexity of the theories that have been presented and you juxtapose those to the sort of cartoony official story of they live in caves and hate us for our freedom, which is the plot of the Roadrunner cartoon.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that's that level of simplicity that it could be turned into a comic book.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to straw man, right?
Yeah,
because I understand that the investigation, as sparse and simple and quick as it was not just like, you know, people showing pictures of the Roadrunner.
Right.
Or the Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah.
But so much of it just seems like misdirection to me, even in the conspiracy world. Like, I never understood the Building 7, why that was so compelling. I mean, I understand what was in the building, like the emergency management system, and then maybe all of these other things like an SEC office or other government agencies that could have been investigating the Hammer Fund were there. But the idea that the Pentagon, well, the Pentagon got hit in its budget accounting office a day after Donald Rumsfeld announced that $2 trillion were unaccounted for. So there are weird things like that.
Yeah.
James Corbett. Have you guys ever seen James Corbett's video called 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory?
Nope. Mm-hmm.
We should probably include it in this show.
Okay.
How long is it?
3 or 4 minutes.
Okay.
You want to do that?
Sure.
Let me see if I can pull it up.
I think, except for the least astute of people, I don't think most people believe that what's been reported about 9/11 is entirely accurate.
Mm-hmm. But it's the holes that allow people to fill in some pretty ridiculous things.
Right. Yeah, you can go pretty far with a lot of that, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I like I guess I appreciate about your perspective, Brett, that you're not saying that if everybody knew that this was true, then everything would change. Everybody would become an anarchist.
People wouldn't even believe it. Look how bad I am at explaining it. People wouldn't even understand it.
I don't think you're bad at explaining it. I'm just saying, like, I appreciate that you're not like, this is so important. It's going to change everything if everybody knows. Like, no, it's not going to change anything.
Right. No. It's really, I don't think it's that important at all. And we know it's not the only time that if this is what it is, it's not the only time like that something has happened.
Sure.
But we have people also have this simplistic language of talking about it. The government did 9/11. What does that even mean?
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
And then libertarians, like one of the most infuriating things that I heard is like the government, like the people who give us our driver's license. You know, like government couldn't do this because government is too inefficient.
The more people who are in on something, the more odds that something's going to go wrong, right? Something's going to get screwed up.
Right. But there's also this kind of covert world, this part of government. There's a part of government that serves us. You know, they do schools, they do the DMV, they do the roads.
Yeah. That's serving us.
It sucks. But then there's this part of government that serves other people. And they're pretty good, you know, like the CIA, the NSA.
Is pretty efficient.
They kind of have their shit together,
right?
You know, more so than the DMV.
Perhaps more so than the DMV, but I don't know if I'd go so like something about that just doesn't. I don't know what the evidence is like for real that the NSA is like a competent organization that has their shit together. Like I've heard they are losing data. You know, like they're this big scary octopus that's wrapping its tentacles around the world, like in their logo, and they have this badass image. But how good are they really at keeping all this data straight?
If you look at the Snowden revelations, like what Edward Snowden revealed, yes, a lot of that stuff was predicted, which is kind of like what Brett was saying. You know, some of this stuff ends up coming very true because some people have already talked about these kind of theories, like Casper Boden and some others. But when you realize that most people had no clue that any of that was going on, they're pretty good. Like, I mean, that a lot of people had no idea of the breadth to which they were surveilling, you know, the planet. I'd say they kind of have their act together. I don't know.
I mean, I just have yet to see like the evidence that they're actually using it to like do anything to anybody. They can't catch terrorists, which is their like supposed goal. They're not like...
Well, but that's inferring that that's their real goal, but that's getting conspiratorial.
Right. So, okay, well, what is their real goal? If their real goal is to just like keep an eye on people, then we'll never know if they're doing a good job of it or not because we're not getting any feedback about that. You know what I mean? Because they're not like cracking down on people. I don't know. Until I see some big evidence that they're actually like, let's say they built a map of every Bitcoin address and who owns it and like what it was for. Mm-hmm. Then I would be like, yeah, that's impressive. But I haven't seen anything like that, you know?
There's an NSA whistleblower named Bill Binney who was pretty high up. Have you heard that name?
It's ringing a bell, yeah.
Tragedy and Hope did a film called The Future of Freedom with him. I think it was like 3 or 4 hours. And he just lays it all out. Here's what I was involved in. Here's what I worked on. And then you do have this. It's the same. It's the MK Ultra question, right? Mm-hmm. MK Ultra was real. The NSA is real.
How effective are they, though?
Right.
You know, there's a lot of debate about MK Ultra. I mean, some people think MK Ultra is ongoing.
Right.
You know, or Project Mockingbird, you know, the CIA effort to infiltrate the mainstream media.
Yeah, exactly.
Which might have already been a success.
Yeah.
In many ways. But does the project still exist under another name? I would assume that there is something similar to MK Ultra that still goes on, even if the MK Ultra program no longer runs, but I don't know the answer.
Sure. That.
I just honestly don't know. So Binney's revelations from somebody who was actually, you know, doing the design, very frightening, the things that they're trying to do. And also all of these other industries or these other companies that have, you know, popped up around the surveillance industry, building things that are built into the devices that we own. And right. When I first heard about this, I was like, oh, is this your toaster watches you kind of stuff? You know, but our phones, especially, you know, with tracking devices, listening devices, you know, keystroking devices, it's in there. You know, it's part of the technology. And we all know that all the telecom companies, except one where the guy went to jail, what was that, like almost 10 years ago?
Yeah.
Are totally willing to play ball
with
them.
So they get a lot of help, too, from, I mean, if we want to call telecom private, I don't really know if it is.
Yeah.
But yeah. When you're controlled by the SEC so much, I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So before we get too far away from this, go ahead with what you want to say.
Oh, I was going to say, like, they get a lot of help from us, too. Like,
absolutely.
Just turn off our phones and not bring them, you know.
Facebook?
Yeah. Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
Indeed.
So here's Corbett's video is about 4 minutes. We can watch some of it. You get the gist of it. It's thought-provoking. It's called 9/11, A Conspiracy Theory.
On the morning of September 11th, 2001, 19 men armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave fortress halfway around the world using a satellite phone and a laptop directed the most sophisticated penetration of the most heavily defended airspace in the world, overpowering the passengers and the military combat-trained pilots on 4 commercial aircraft before flying those planes wildly off course for over an hour without being molested by a single fighter interceptor. These 19 hijackers, devout religious fundamentalists who like to drink alcohol, snort cocaine, and live with pink-haired strippers, managed to knock down 3 buildings with 2 planes in New York. While in Washington, a pilot who couldn't handle a single-engine Cessna was able to fly a 757 in an 8,000-foot descending 270-degree corkscrew turn to come exactly level with the ground, hitting the Pentagon in the budget analyst office where DOD staffers were working on the mystery of the $2.3 trillion that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had announced missing from the Pentagon's coffers in a press conference the day before, on September 10th, 2001. Luckily, the news anchors knew who did it within minutes.
Osama bin Laden.
The pundits knew within hours.
Osama bin Laden.
The administration knew within the day.
Terrorists who committed these acts and those who harbor them.
And the evidence literally fell into the FBI's lap.
That a hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
But for some reason, a bunch of crazy conspiracy theorists demanded an investigation into the greatest attack on American soil in history. That investigation was delayed, underfunded, set up to fail, a conflict of interest, and a cover-up from start to finish. It was based on testimony extracted through torture, the records of which were destroyed. It failed to mention the existence of WTC-7, Able Danger, PTEC, Sibel Edmonds, OBL and the CIA, and the drills of hijacked aircraft being flown into buildings that were being simulated at the precise same time that those events were actually happening. It was lied to by the Pentagon, the CIA, the Bush administration, and as for Bush and Cheney, well, no one knows what they told it because they testified in secret, off the record, not under oath, and behind closed doors. It didn't bother to look at who funded the attacks because that question is ultimately of little practical significance. Still, the 9/11 Commission did brilliantly, answering all of the questions the public had, except most of the victims' family members' questions, and pinned blame on all the people responsible, although no one so much as lost their job, determining the attacks were
failure of imagination.
Because
nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government that could envision flying airplanes into buildings.
Except the Pentagon, FEMA, NORAD, and the NRO. The DIA destroyed 2.5 terabytes of data on Able Danger, but that's okay because it probably wasn't important. The SEC destroyed their records on the investigation into the insider trading before the attacks, but that's okay because destroying the records of the largest investigation in SEC history is just part of routine record keeping. NIST has classified the data that they used for their model of WTC-7's collapse, but that's okay because knowing how they made their model of the collapse would jeopardize public safety. The FBI has argued that all material related to their investigation of 9/11 should be kept secret from the public, but that's okay because the FBI probably has nothing to hide. This man never existed, nor is anything he had to say worthy of your attention, and if you say otherwise, you are a paranoid conspiracy theorist and deserve to be shunned by all of humanity. Likewise, him, and her.
All right, well, that's rich right there. This guy was, I believe he's one of the people whose claim is that they were in the building and heard other explosions.
Her and him. Osama bin Laden lived in a cave fortress in the hills of Afghanistan, but somehow got away. Then he was hiding out in Tora Bora, but somehow got away. Then he lived in Abbottabad for years, taunting the most comprehensive intelligence dragnet employing the most sophisticated technology in the history of the world for a decade, releasing video after video with complete impunity and getting younger and younger as he did so, before finally being found in a daring SEAL team raid which wasn't recorded on video, in which he didn't resist or use his wife as a human shield, and in which these crack special forces operatives panicked and killed this unarmed man, supposedly the best source of intelligence about those dastardly terrorists on the entire planet. Then they dumped his body in the ocean before telling anyone about it. Then a couple dozen of that team's members died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. This is the story of 9/11, brought to you by the media which told you the hard truths about
his head could be seen to move violently forward.
And
they took the babies out of incubators.
And
mobile production facilities.
And
the rescue of Jessica Lynch.
If you have any questions about this story, you are a batshit, paranoid, tinfoil, dog-abusing baby hater and will be reviled by everyone. If you love your country and or freedom, happiness, rainbows, rock and roll, puppy dogs, apple pie, and your grandma, you will never ever express doubts about any part of this story to anyone. Ever. This has been a public service announcement by the Friends of the FBI, CIA, NSA, DIA, SEC, MSM, White House, NIST, and the 9/11 Commission. Because ignorance is strength.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
It's a good introduction to a lot of this stuff. I like that video, but but no, I'll dabble in the moon.
All right, I was gonna go with the moon too.
Oh boy, okay.
I mean, as one of them, but go ahead.
But the only thing that is really compelling about that is a motive to fake it, in addition to the challenge of getting there. Right. And also, the Soviets had almost landed. Not a man. Weeks or months before, the Soviets had launched a probe that was supposed to go there and retrieve a rock sample. But it crashed. It hit the moon.
Right.
So they were first to crash into the moon. But there's another story too, that in the 1950s, when they didn't think a manned moon mission was possible, and they were still dealing with this prospect of losing this technological race to the Soviets, which would have been really devastating from a geopolitical and PR standpoint.
Sure.
The original plan that was developed by the U.S. Air Force, I think it was called Project A-119, was they were going to hit the moon with a ballistic missile.
Right.
You knew this.
I know about this one.
Yeah, they were going to nuke the moon, but they decided that would also be bad PR.
Why would they do that?
Just to
see if they could hit it?
Because we can.
Well, there's conspiracies within that.
No way.
Itself. Oh, yeah.
Really? Like, yeah. What?
Well, because that's where the lizards live.
That's why they wanted to do it, because they're aliens on the moon.
Smithereens, because they got to take out the people that are there.
Wait, I thought the lizards lived underground.
No. You see, this is the latest David Icke book. So there's the Vril, the coming... Yeah. See, we
go for it.
Forever.
Go for it. Go for it.
Conspirathon.
Go for it.
Brett's so excited.
Do it.
Right. So, yeah, you got a few different areas where these people come from. All right. Now, if you take David Icke's word, he would say that actually the moon in and of itself is a fake construct, it was built. And there are some genuine oddities about the moon. This is so, like the fact that it rings like a bell when they would, if you initially even believe that they went there, that humans went to the moon. But there's the idea, there was a book in the late 19th century called Vril, the Coming Race, and supposedly that was not fiction. That was actually a true story. In fact, there's a 12-volume series about the Vril that treats them as nonfiction.
And are the Vril lizard people?
Yes, kind of. And that's why the Nazis wanted
to go away. In what way are they not lizardy? In what way are they lizardy?
They're not exactly scaly in description in the book called The Coming Race.
So V is for Vril.
Yeah, well, right. Instead of visitor.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit.
I love that series.
Okay, go ahead and go on.
But David Icke's recent work says that actually most of reality is a hologram being projected from the moon. And that these, this lizard race that wears red dresses is transmit, they live mainly on the moon. And so the theory would go that that project to send a ballistic missile to the moon would be to put an end to the power of, of this lizard super race.
Well, what if they broke the hologram?
Well, that they'd want that to happen.
What?
Yeah.
To free us.
Yes.
So it's like the Matrix.
Yes. In a sense, yeah. Which Icke loves the Matrix, using that as a story to describe things, an analogy.
Damn. Well, so when we were talking about this before, we were speculating that the whole reptilian thing is some kind of metaphor.
Right.
But I've heard him say things like, I've seen them shapeshift. I've seen their eyes change.
I've seen their scales and their skin peeling off and eyelids blinking sideways.
Yeah, I mean, there's other books. Secrets of the Reptiles, I believe, is the name of the book. And that goes into it lays out without, and I give it credit because it doesn't go to much in the way of conclusion, but it just lays out all this historicity of the importance of serpents within recorded human history, and then even beyond. Like, it goes into the, like, there's a theory that doesn't come from conspiracy theorists, comes from scientists, that Trunodon, which was a dinosaur, a very small dinosaur, kind of picture a velociraptor, a third its size.
Yeah.
Okay. That eventually became a bipedal lizard, and that it never went extinct, and it became very intelligent, kind of like how, you know, in the Jurassic Park movies, how velociraptors are depicted as being, you know, able to even like communicate with each other and things like this. And so that this Trunodon is where the entire lizard race comes from. So, and because the original gods that we find largely throughout history are serpent, you know, serpent based. And so that, yeah, there we go. As far as the evidence for all that, there's very little. So, but I'm just laying it out. There it is.
Dang.
Brett had a picture on his Facebook of one of those Trunodons once, I think.
Yeah, I don't remember why I made that my profile picture, but for a while it was my profile picture on Facebook.
Sure. Brian thought that was great. He was like, oh, Brett knows about this.
Oh, I did know about it because we were talking about it on this other show I was on called Wheels Off Liberty.
Uh-huh.
And that was it, that had something to do with me making my profile picture a reptilian.
Right.
So, I mean, as far as I'm willing to go with the moon is that there was obviously a great degree of difficulty and there was a motive and an urgency.
Sure.
But I've never really thought, see, I mean, the problem that I've always had with conspiracy, whether it's JFK or the moon or 9/11, is that the people who are promoting the conspiracies usually want to take it into a realm of the abstruse, right? Things that it's very, very hard for the layperson to understand,
right?
Right. So the whole 9/11 conspiracy revolves around physics, mostly,
yeah, sure,
and engineering.
There might the melting point of steel and that kind of thing,
right? Right. And there's a lot of variables that are left out of all of these discussions, but the believer. Mm-hmm. You know, they hear something that sounds plausible, and then with JFK, it's ballistics, and again, with the moon, it's physics, or the Van Allen radiation belt, or...
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they say, yeah, well, how could... Yeah. I mean, I came here to believe, you know?
Yeah.
So how could anything else be true? But you're looking at a very, very narrow version of everything that could be presented. So when I try to tell my story about what I believe about 9/11, it has nothing to do with any of that. And I mm-hmm. think all of that is a distraction. I don't, you know, people, when people say something like no steel building had ever collapsed due to fire, right? Well, were there other steel buildings that were built that way, that were right. hit by planes? That,
there's so many variables.
You know, that had a 7-story deep foundation that had that kind of internal structure.
Right.
You know, it's crazy to even make that comparison, I think.
Yeah.
And I always saw Building 7 as kind of like a red herring. Why couldn't a building that had sufficient damage from stuff, another building falling on part of it or a fire burning it in all day or having huge diesel generators that go up in flames that are on the 7th floor, all of those buildings just collapsing? I don't see why that's impossible. And that they couldn't fall at free fall speed, I don't know that they did.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they couldn't. And I don't think they did, you know? I think that so much of this has just been like echo chamber. So the questions of motives, who benefits, those things are much more important than getting involved in debates about physics with people who aren't physicists when you are also not a physicist.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah,
those absolutely. Seem like dead ends to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with the moon landing, I mean, there are two things that really stand out as strange.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's footage where it's very clear that they are backing up like the lens to make it appear that they're further away from the Earth than they are. That's if, you know, Buzz and Neil were actually in space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's kind of an oddity. Then the original footage or the original film reel from the, you know, the mission, the Apollo 11 mission, on like its, what was it? Not its 50th anniversary, but there was an anniversary, big anniversary that it had. And they're like, oh yeah, we lost that reel. Like, the original's gone. We've got plenty of copies, but the original is gone. And so like those two things, yeah, very strange, you know, but where you take, yeah, I mean, and those are just the two that I thought were you know, gave it the most kind of maybe credibility, right?
So explain the backing up the lens thing to me.
Kind of like on a cell phone or like on a camera, how you can zoom in and zoom out. So
okay.
They zoomed out to make it look like they were further away from the Earth than they actually were.
So I don't know how far away this dangerous radiation is from the Earth.
Like the second Van Allen belt, you
mean? Yeah.
Right.
That they couldn't go. I don't know if it's like 100 miles, 1,000 miles.
Yeah, I don't recall the exact numbers.
But every other space mission, mm-hmm. either by the United States or the Soviet Union or any other country that ever went into space, was all inside. Apollo is the only one that ever went outside of it. So you're mm-hmm. saying they could have gone to the edge of it and photographed the Earth. That would be the theory?
Yeah, the theory would be is that they took a shot to make it seem like, and I mean, and they're even like there's some degree of conversation, if I remember correctly, where it's like, yeah, okay, back it up, you know, mm-hmm. So yeah, the shot was being made to, but I mean, the explanation that it's just them making it look good for television, you know, like for the time frame. That all of this is kind of getting transmitted,
yeah,
or whatever.
That sounds totally reasonable.
Is, yeah, in my opinion, is just as reasonable as saying, okay, we can't go past the second Van Allen belt. So there's explanations both ways. I definitely, you know, and people get into the photographic discrepancies, right?
I don't have any frame of reference for any of that.
Sure. So there's an interesting book, and here's kind of the third. With a lot of these conspiracy theories, there's always kind of a third option.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And the third option I found, and I find it decently compelling, and I'm willing to go I'm willing enough to say I believe it.
Okay.
Some of it, anyway, is that the reason that there's discrepancies, say, in the photographs, isn't that they didn't land on the moon. But actually that they did land there, they found things that they had to hide. And so that's why the photographs are so strange, is because they were covering stuff up from there.
No shit.
Yeah. So there's a book called Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. It's written by Richard Hoagland and Mike Barra. Richard Hoagland, at one point, had some degree of credibility. He actually worked for NASA, et cetera.
Yeah.
He's most famous for doing the Face on Mars series back in the 90s. You know, this book, Dark Mission, goes into some very strange areas, like claiming that there's cities on Mars and all this stuff. And then there's a famous picture that you can Google called Mitchell Under Glass, which is Ed Mitchell on the moon. And supposedly it's him sitting standing inside a glass structure. Okay. Then there's also another picture called Data's Head, where it's a picture from where they color corrected it a little bit, you know, Richard Hoagland and his group color corrected it, and looks like this shot on the moon that was taken, you know, by various astronauts, where it looks like it's a robot, you know, that it's the head of a robot and even has like some degree of blood on it. It makes an interesting case. I don't buy at Mitchell Under Glass. If you look at the picture, it's not compelling. If you look at Data's Head, as they call it, I don't find it very compelling. But the theory overall that they went there and they kind of hid things. In fact, so that book came out probably 5, 6, 7 years ago. This was a plot point used in a recent Transformers film, mm-hmm. that you know, they go to radio silence, or whatever, you know, Neil and Buzz go to radio silence and they go running off. There you go. You got Data's head up on the screen there. But overall, like I could almost believe this, that they found things perhaps up there that they hid. You know, that's why there's discrepancies, or maybe that they put things up there that they hid. Either way, that they were doing stuff on the moon that they needed to hide, or something was going on the moon that needed to be hidden. And that's the middle ground as far as what actually happened. Yes, they landed there. Yes, there's a lot of discrepancies, but that's all because the real purpose of the mission is very, you know, is not known.
Right, because there was no real reason given for it, right? And we've just kind of speculated it. No one's ever said, this is awesome PR in right. our technological struggle against the Soviet Union that right. we were first to the moon. Like, no NASA official or government official or U.S. president ever said that.
Sure.
And even when Kennedy talked about it and when Johnson talked about
it. Because it was there. That's why we're doing it.
Because we not – what did Kennedy say? Because we –
yeah, he says, you know, he says when the guy wanted to climb Mount Everest, why did he do it? He says, because it was there, and we're going to climb the moon because it is there. That's all they said.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was no, I mean, it was like just this mission of exploration. That's the only real reason you give. It's as bad as what you're taught in school about World War I, where it's like, oh, because this guy got assassinated, America went into World War I. He's like, are you kidding me? It has nothing to do with it.
So it's possible that
a moon mission, especially if we think about how much, you know, black military money could disappear mm-hmm. into NASA's budget, that there right. could have been mm-hmm. some kind of military application
sure.
for a project like that, which would have mean parts of it had to be hidden.
Right.
But I just haven't seen anything compelling. The reason why I said that's as far as I'll go is it's the most entertaining. And yeah, I did yeah. a show about this maybe like almost 3 years ago where I said, I hope it was fake. I hope Stanley Kubrick was involved. I want to believe this so much. You know, yeah. I have so much. And I remember when we were researching it, I had like so much confirmation bias to like, yes, yes.
Yeah, I remember you saying that on the show and I really appreciated that. And it is entertaining. I mean, it is interesting and fun to think about.
Somebody had sent this video, the confession hidden in The Shining.
Oh, the yeah, The Shining Code, right?
2. The Shining Code, yeah, right? And that. I'm like, I sped right home to watch it with my brother, and I was so disappointed. I was like, I'm sorry I made you watch this.
Yeah.
But then finding this other video on YouTube where they're interviewing Donald Rumsfeld, mm-hmm. and I, for like 2 minutes, this went on when I was like, oh my goodness, what is this? Like, my confirmation bias was so strong that for, I swear, it was no more than 2 or 3 minutes, I bought into what is clearly a spoof documentary. And a lot of people still don't know that it is, right? Because of how it's edited. It's like Donald Rumsfeld and Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon.
Okay.
But they're all talking about something different. And then it's just cleverly edited into this narrative.
We walked out of the room and President Nixon said, I've decided to do that and I need you to do this job. We're going to do it. It was just amazing. So we were trying to figure out who would do what when. He simply has got to have the person he wants in that job. And it has to be someone who's capable of doing it. And it has to be somebody he knows well. I said, I'd like to talk to one person. And he said, who?
Donald Rumsfeld was the first to propose Stanley Kubrick. The film would have to be perfect, but the set could never be built in time. The filming of 2001, A Space Odyssey, was drawing to a close in a suburb of London. Why not use the sets there? Rumsfeld was sure that Kubrick would not refuse. During the Kennedy administration, the White House had granted him special authorization to access strategic areas of the Pentagon during the preparations for the film Dr. Strangelove. Kubrick owed them. I told Mr. Nixon, it's very dangerous to lie in the United States. You can't pull a con like that in a democracy. Too many people would talk. It would be absurd. But he said, almost sadly, go ahead anyway. Rumsfeld offered to go and negotiate personally with Stanley Kubrick. He and Henry Kissinger flew to England that same evening. Kubrick was surprised and amused by the idea, but began by refusing. Rumsfeld wouldn't give up. We're only asking you to do one thing. Just leave us the keys to the studio for one weekend, just so we can shoot a bit of film and take a few shots. Everything will be tidied up again by Monday morning. Kissinger flattered him, telling him that Dr. Strangelove was one of Nixon's favorite films. In the end, Kubrick agreed. The fake footage would be shot in England in the MGM studios near Boreham Wood with a skeleton crew. The two technicians and two actors would be CIA agents. To guarantee their trustworthiness, all had to be single men without family ties. They would sign a contract committing themselves to perpetual silence about the whole affair. Once the filming was over, they would have to disappear. But Stanley Kubrick was a perfectionist. Faced with a CIA crew's lack of professionalism, he ended up, against his better judgment, supervising the shooting of the fake moonwalk. But, he told them, from Monday morning, you're out of my life for good.
My goodness, that is somebody. He is impressive, and he is a balanced, rational man. And he also has some courage to say that, what he'd said. And from there on, it played out exactly as he suggested.
He had very great common sense. He was a very dedicated personality. And my relations with him were wonderful.
Kissinger was the key person. Yeah, that's right.
Have you ever seen this?
No, I haven't, but I can picture it.
I think it's called The Dark Side of the Moon.
All right.
Which is, as a title, is also kind of like, come on, pay attention, pay attention, nitwits.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, I really want to believe this more than any other conspiracy theory. Mm. And that's why I would put it at the top of willing to believe. I sure. mean, most other things that I think people call conspiracies that are compelling are not theories. You know, MK Ultra is
not a theory, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the theory is like, how much impact has it had on culture, I guess.
Exactly. Or, yeah,
that's
sure.
That's the theory aspect of it.
Right. But most of it is declassified at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there you're right, because I'm being accused right now of being a part of it, MKUltra. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's your leopard print sex kitten lingerie outfit?
Yeah, which personality are you running on? Beta, theta, or...
See, you're beyond me. This is like, you're beyond...
This is like the Marilyn Monroe. You guys talk about that. So...
Well, I'm not saying I believe any of this.
Okay.
So let me be clear on
anyway.
That. But yeah, so the theory is that MKUltra is still going on. Like you have, an Operation Mockingbird as well as Operation Monarch or Project Monarch.
Mm-hmm.
And that it is all being, you know, run within in pop, like pop music. Like there's a lot of symbology that has a recurring theme, like the covering of one eye. As well as animal print, rainbows, the two columns that's common in Freemasonry, as a lot of other Freemasonic
butterflies,
symbols.
Yeah.
Butterflies,
Mason
yeah, which is representative of Project Monarch. A lot of these things, and that a bunch of people have been turned into, what's the guy's name?
Fritz Springmeier?
Fritz, thank you. Yeah, Fritz Springmeier. Yeah, he talked a lot about this, and there was even a woman that came out, Susan something. That she claimed she was one of these, you know, dolls made as a sleeper agent out of MKUltra, and
they're turning women into programmable, like controllable puppets. Basically.
Yeah, they're turning humans in general into these programmable puppets, and they have different levels of personality that can be accessed. There's the alpha personality, which I think is the operating system. There's the beta personality, which is the turns them into a sex kitten. And then there's Gamma, which is the assassin, personality and all this. I mean,
you're going to want that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly complex.
And it's all done through traumatizing them and creating these multiple personalities.
Oh my God, that's like internal family systems therapy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is. It is. Actually,
yeah, that's
because
another symbol that's commonplace is like a broken mirror. Which signifies their like multiple personalities that they have within them. And there's one website, I hate to keep plugging it, but the guy does his work. So vigilantcitizen.com.
Okay.
And like, he'll do like picks of the month, and it's just, you know, he makes a case where it's just like, wow, you know, look at this, look in each one of these, you know,
he goes through like magazines and like pop culture and like music videos and stuff. And he picks out little screenshots and from like models and like fashion shows and pop stars, and it's all just like either they have got like one eye, or they're doing some weird like sexual pose that's just like completely out of place, or they're dressed as a puppet, or they're dressed as like a robot, or they're in a broken mirror, their face is split.
Robot's another common one too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, you get into some really, you know, you can go very, very far out, but all of this supposedly ties back to MKUltra. I don't really believe a stitch of it, but it's out there, and people make a very interesting picture.
I will say, when I didn't know about this at all until Brian and I had a conversation about it one day. And after that, I started to notice, like, I would get Victoria's Secret catalogs in the mail. Every page has a girl covering one eye with her hair. Or something. And every page has a girl wearing a butterfly necklace or like angel wings with like butterfly wings or animal print. Or there's like columns and a Freemason like checkerboard floor.
But okay, fine. But think about how much we've expanded this, right? So like you watch somebody like Mark Dice.
Right.
And he's like, this is an Illuminati symbol. This is an Illuminati symbol. But when he gets done, he's listed like 40 things.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's true.
Yeah.
Signs.
That's exactly what I said.
Signs on poles.
Yeah.
Things that stand up straight.
Yeah,
so
colors.
Absolutely.
I hope I'm not strawmanning, but it seems like it comes back to the Shining Code. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, look at all the 11s that Stanley Kubrick hid in this film. Here is a doorway. Notice how each side of the door is a line making an 11.
Well, that's the thing is like a lot of people just start to take it to that level.
And they'll start to see what they want to see.
Exactly.
But I get what you're saying.
Well, that's what I was pointing out. It was like once Brian said that to me, I could see it. You know what I mean? But I wouldn't have noticed it otherwise.
Exactly.
So people it is confirmation bias, or it was for me when I started to notice that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it means. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of like modeling or pop music or anything like that. I could even believe that maybe just like it's an archetype or something when you go to photography
an artistic
school.
Archetype.
Yeah, it's an artistic archetype. Covering one eye looks beautiful or something. And, you know, it's an element of composition in photography.
Absolutely.
I could totally believe that. And I don't know what it means, even if it's true. Like if there are these pop starlets that are, you know, showing off that they have handlers and they're just like puppets of the Illuminati. Like one of the questions I had when I first found out about this stuff was like, you know, why are they putting, what's the point of like putting it on display, like hiding it in plain sight in pop culture, you know? Mm-hmm. And Brian said, maybe it's like showing homage to like their gods. It's like some secret religion and they're like trying to show, I don't know.
It's a ritual.
Yeah, it's a ritual.
Yeah,
and
some
like
of it's
they're
pretty...
doing, they're flaunting it like, haha, look at, we're doing this in plain sight. Everybody can see it, but nobody knows what it really means, you know?
Hmm. Yeah. So the idea that they do like very open rituals is, you know, they, them, those, whatever the heck that is. I mean, that, right. That's kind of it. Or that, you know, the theory goes for some people, you read the works of Christopher Knight or Alan Butler, and they talk about that this group wants to make this world presentable for their God when their God returns, you know, on a certain day when not the Shemitah, but the Shekinah. You know, shows up again, you know, when we have a super Shekinah. I mean, this is how far all this can go. See,
do you know what that is, Brett?
Super Shekinah?
Super
I'm going to find ways to work it into my conversations That's from right. now on. But no, I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
It's when Mars and Venus.
No, Mercury and Venus.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So, okay.
You better explain this.
So, are we okay with going this direction?
Yeah,
that's the whole point of the show.
All right.
Go
so,
full bore.
Yeah. So in real science, Venus does, you know, make a trip every 8 years, and it shows up more or less within the same part of the sky, you know, on Earth. Venus is a very popular thing to, you know, for ancient humans to use as a, you know, a gauge of time. You know, direction, things like that. And that's, in fact, like where the goddess Ishtar comes from. You know, that's all based around Venus and all of this. And so every 8 years it makes that trip, but then every 40, it pretty much covers the entire zodiac. Okay. And at that point, that's supposedly where even the pentagram comes from. Is because it
8 times 5, yeah.
Right. It covers this whole area that, you know, like a pentacle. You have that, and then every with the 40 years, there is, oh boy, this is some wild math. But anyway, the 40 years is where the generation comes from, and where were we going with this? Because I think I just...
Super Shekinah.
Super Shekinah, right. Okay, so...
Thank you, Brett, for giving us back.
Thank you so much. Yeah, so in this 40 years, like Mercury and Venus will like kind of come together, and they make one large star. And so the theory goes, at that point, important things have to happen. Like supposedly Jesus, you know, came around, you know, when the Shekinah glory was in the sky and everything. And that pretty much every temple you can imagine, even there's that really old one in Ireland that I can't think of the name of at the moment. Really, really old temple. But all of this is designed to have the light of the Shekinah come into it. Even the, you know, Jewish, you know, Solomon's temple was designed to have the Shekinah come into it. And I mean, and that's where the, you know, the whole phrase Shekinah comes from, is the Shekinah glory. That's the holiest of holies that you walk into in the temple. And so the idea is basically that there is a group that has been around forever that worships the Shekinah and is, you know, a religion within every religion that's ever existed. And they are wanting to make the world presentable to this, you know, to whatever their concept of God is. And so that's why they're putting all of their symbology and they're getting everybody into it in pop culture, is because that time when the next Shekinah is supposed to happen is very soon. Oh, boy.
Wow.
Yes. Wow.
Well, how do we get to Super Shekinah? Because where were we right
Super
before?
Super Shemitah.
Well, we were talking about MK Ultra and why are these pop symbols like out there?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Or why are
they're,
these symbols in pop culture?
They're preparing the world for their God.
They're preparing the world for their God. And so we went into what may be the origin of all of it. But
so we're distinguishing from mind control to basically symbology.
Yeah.
Right. Which could be a kind of mind control.
that's what's implied in a lot of these symbology awareness alarmist right. kind of videos. Yeah.
Right.
It's like they're using this to control you. Triangles, man.
Well, that's yeah. like, was it Confucius that said symbols rule the world?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right. And so I think there's some truth to
that. I don't even agree with that at all.
Well, hold on. Because what happens when somebody sees an American flag? What do?
Vomit.
Okay, right. Yeah. You just got controlled. What does somebody else do? Somebody else goes, oh, you know, they hold their hand over their heart or something.
Yeah.
You know, no, so there's some truth anything, to the fact that's, no, but there's some truth to the fact that symbols do create a reaction. You know, and so maybe there's people who think that certain symbols create, and it's all might be all nonsense.
Especially if this has some kind of occult thing where right. there's a deeper understanding than most people have of the subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
What is seeing an eye?
Sure.
Mean? What mm-hmm. does it communicate on a subconscious level?
Yeah. Right. Does one eye, like, does everybody kind of subconsciously see that as a god is, oh, I'm being watched. I better be on my best behavior. You know, I mean, things of this nature. So there's some truth to it.
The thing, though, with mind control is it kind of takes us back to where we were at the beginning here with mm-hmm. spheres of control.
Right.
Right. When people don't feel like they start to wake up to the fact that what was presented as the truth might not be the truth or the whole truth. Right.
Right.
They get past denial and they get into anger and then they get stuck in anger. Well, how do you explain, you know, this strong, what were the two things that Tim Melly said in the book? A strong sense of individualism coupled with
control.
A sense of powerlessness or loss of control.
Right.
So what do you tell yourself? You know, why is this conspiracy theory of mind control, which exists all over the place in many real forms, but why is it so compelling, right? Because mm-hmm. it's everybody else is out of control,
yeah.
right? How could I possibly make it in a world filled with zombies, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Zombies?
Yeah, I'd like to say zombies. Zombies. Yeah, I like to say zombies. I don't know.
Like Amish instead of Amish?
Yeah.
That might have been insulting, but...
Wow.
Zombies.
Okay. Yeah.
You're not the first person to stop me and say, did you mean zombies? Yeah.
I was thinking...
It's like saying
you know
Nazis.
Those machines that like smooth out the ice in an ice skating rink?
Zambonis. You know how we met in secret a while back and I said I was going to start slipping Yiddish words into the podcast and not talking about why I'm doing it? Sometimes I just like to say things in a Chicago accent all of a sudden for no reason with no explanation. So zombies.
That works.
Zombies. Have you seen the zombies? They're everywhere, these zombies. I just like to do that. I don't know. It's just one of my tics. So, okay. Yeah, there's that. And I guess to bring it back on track, I was... Did we get to you, or did we accidentally get to as far as Brian is willing to go with conspiracies? Because this all grew out of our, I will take it to the Apollo hoax level. But I'll dabble. I won't take it there and plant my feet and say, no, I'm not listening to what anyone else has to say. I will dabble and I'll dip my toes.
Because you want to believe.
I want to believe. I'm willing to say that that's something I want to, that would be so awesome. If that was now, what would that change? You know, we talk about JFK. I really think JFK at this point, 52 years later, nothing. What would it change?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just don't think that that would be really transformative. 9/11 at this point, almost 15 years out, you know?
Right.
Well, 14 years this September. I don't know. I still think that it would be chaotic. To get definitive proof that mm-hmm. the official story wasn't true.
I don't think the culture would change. Like, there are kids who are growing up now who were born in 2001 that are 15 years old, 14 years old, and have no sense of privacy, don't know what it was like to go through an airport security that wasn't TSA.
Right.
You know, like, don't remember what life was like before Facebook and cell phones. And yeah, I mean, like, there's just... I think there's a lot of cultural stuff that's been implanted or yeah. that's just been like ingrained in a lot of people's consciousness. And it's part of the narrative now. And even if 9/11 was proven to be not the official story, that probably won't change.
You know, it's interesting. I'm listening to you say that. And I remember going back to my classroom in 2005 and we were watching this documentary about 9/11.
And you see the scene where Flight 175 crashes into the South Tower.
Yeah.
And like two kids in the class, this was 2005, two kids in the class go something like, "Holy shit, that's the craziest thing I've ever seen." And I was like,
they didn't know about
you've
it.
Never seen this? Mm. Mm. You've never seen this? Two kids, there were nine kids in the class. Two of them had never seen it. Mm. And you think about that, like, this is just the world, no questions asked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the world, I mean, it was different then, you know, as far as the encroachment of, you know, but it was still all happening, you know.
Yeah.
Airport security. I mean, I was taking kids through the airport back then. It wasn't easy then. That was startling to me.
Yeah.
That 4 years later, there were people who were, you know, 10, 11 years old when it happened that had never seen it. Mm-hmm. And now there's people who were, I mean, there's people who are entering high school who were born after that. So it's weird to think about for sure. But go ahead.
I guess I kind of hinted at the theory, how far I'm willing to go, mm-hmm. which is more or less this idea of Prisca Theologia, which was originally named by like St. Augustine. I won't go into a whole bunch of detail, but just the idea
Theologica,
that
the first religion.
Yeah, that's what it means, is like the prime theology, the first theology. Mm-hmm. And like, so I'm willing to believe that there was one original religion. Maybe that came from mushrooms. But nice. there was one religion, and that religion in some form or another continued to worm its way to this day. You know, from whatever originally Babylonian to Judaism to like Christianity, even within Catholicism and all this stuff. And, you know, honestly, I think if you could prove that religion all came from some kind of crap, that might actually change some things. Like if you could get really good evidence.
Or something growing on crap.
Yeah. But I think that's one that you could really like help shake a lot of cores.
Yeah.
On, you know, in my opinion, but. And that's sort of the one that I you know, myself, that I in my fun times and my off time that I have fun with exploring, you know, is where did religion originally come from?
You also, regardless of whatever we're talking about, from the moon to, mm-hmm. You know, this one root of all religion to mm-hmm. 9/11 to JFK, you also have this cognitive distortion problem. And I've thought about this. It's like a thought experiment that I've done. There are many people alive right now that no matter what you showed them, they would not change.
Yeah.
You bring George W. Bush to their house. Like, yeah, sorry, we did it. We knew we did it, you know?
Yeah.
They wouldn't believe. I mean, you, there's nothing. And you know what it's, what is that called? When somebody sees the truth, but they won't believe it.
Cognitive dissonance,
yeah, exactly. And I think for a lot of these events, the cognitive dissonance for most people is just too strong.
Yeah.
Then the question of what to do, right? Because this cognitive dissonance is kind of working as an obstacle for many other things as well. Mm-hmm. You know, like something that I think all of us care about more, which is probably the philosophy of liberty, than the truth about JFK or 9/11 right. or the Apollo missions. And that's just as significantly blocked by that for many people.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's very true.
Oh, man. The strategy I've found is like just to find the people who have done a lot of work on themselves and, you know, are kind of willing to confront that cognitive dissonance and share my values and hang around with them and not deal with the greater world that much.
I get what you're saying. I don't want to shut off. It's been in the last few months, I've talked to a lot of people who were not libertarian.
Yeah.
And I found that to be like really enjoyable. But then it's like, is this relationship based on avoiding some important conversation?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times I found that it isn't. Mm-hmm. It's just like, oh, you are a socialist? Well, you know, and then talking about it. And then they're like, well, you know, I don't really know. I don't know. It seems like, I guess I hadn't thought about it that much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's very few people who describe themselves as socialists who've thought about it that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I would rather take somebody who was left-wing and self-aware, like, or at least identifying as left-wing from kind of like a, I just dabble in that world, right. But I want gay people to be able to get married, and I want pot to be legal.
Yeah.
And I even think we should pay more taxes. Like a person who was but self-aware.
Yeah.
I would take that over somebody who was full voluntarist and not wanted nothing to do with their inner world.
Sure.
As far as like a meaningful friendship or a romantic relationship. I might get mail about this, but that's honestly how I feel right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I, you know, honestly, in a lot of ways, I agree. I know there's lots of people who don't want to tax me, who don't want to do all kinds of things to me. But at the same time, I worry about them far more than, you know, the next door neighbor that even has an Obama sticker on there. You know, I mean, sometimes these people are very worrisome.
I don't trust anyone with stickers.
That's a good policy. I'm going to use that from now on. If we don't take anything else away from this show.
Now, they just have one sticker, or are they adults collecting stickers?
Maybe, I don't know. It's your policy.
If adults with sticker collections, I don't trust them.
Yeah. What about paperclip collections?
Paperclip collections.
Yeah. Kind of like Bert and Ernie.
Well, I mean, any organized person could be mistaken as a paperclip collector.
That's a good point.
Yep.
That's actually a really good point.
Like, what are you collecting these things? It's like, no, I'm just having things I'm trying to keep in order here.
Yeah.
Don't judge me.
But no, I can really understand where you're coming from, because I think maybe you feel like you can, you know, delve into the areas that are really important, which is, you know, what's going on inside. As compared to, you know, otherwise. I don't know. You know, I was just going to say, I mean, personally, I don't think we're ever going to have like this, you know, voluntarist world.
Yeah.
I just don't believe it. It's never going to happen. I just can't see people all agreeing on the same, you know, base, even on the same fundamental principle. And I don't think outbreeding them is going to work either because. I
mean, oh, geez, that's crazy talk. Yeah.
Really? No. Statists are going to, you know, they're outbreeding,
people,
you know,
who are
10
breeding
to 1.
Unconsciously by accident. Yeah. Or
sure.
They don't put thought into it, so they're just doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the things that you know, give you the most freedom within the sphere that you exist within, I think, you know, what you can connect with, more importantly on that aspect, I think is definitely the more beneficial and perhaps the more enjoyable.
And it's a great foundation to build on, too.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? Because you could be you could connect on these other things and then run into all kinds of problems, you know, down the road, so...
Yeah, I hear that, Brett, and I've had a similar experiences too, you know, where I thought I really shared a lot of values with someone because they had come to the conclusions of like voluntarism and atheism. But then, you know, you get down to some of those core beliefs that really determine whether a friendship or a relationship is going to go well, and they're not aligned.
Yeah.
You know, and that can be really painful. And it's like it really messes with your mind because you're like, but they're an anarchist, they're a libertarian, like it should... That should mean everything's fine, but it doesn't necessarily.
Yeah.
It's possible to hold a lot of different beliefs that are important to relationships other than that. And I think, like, I agree with you guys both about, like, being able to find connection with somebody who doesn't necessarily, like, call themselves libertarian or whatever. And I don't think the relationship with them would necessarily be based on avoiding certain topics. But, like, in the long term, you got to go there and explore those areas. And if they're still calling themselves a socialist or whatever, or they're still saying, yeah, taxation's not theft, like, a year later after you know them, that would be a problem for me.
Yeah, I mean, there'd be a lot of things. I'm just saying, what's a better foundation to build on?
Yeah.
You know? And I think maybe this is more in the romantic realm. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be ironed out. You know, I mean, I dated a girl years ago, and she was very curious about all of this. It was like when I was getting into Free Talk Live. I think we started dating in like 2008. Mm-hmm. So she would listen to the show with me. She would read about libertarianism online. She had a notebook, you know, she was, because it was important to her. But like when push came to shove and like, you know, I started getting more into the peaceful parenting thing and we just talked about spanking and we talked about, you know, commitment and I started doing School Sucks podcast. it was like that was a very thin foundation, you know. It was taken as seriously as, oh, you like tennis? I'll try tennis, you know. Yeah. But it wasn't really going to translate into a way of living or a way of acting when it came to, you know, how children should be treated or should children go to public school or not. And those were things that after we had been together over a year and a half started to come up, and they need to be addressed, you know. You can slip someone's thoughts about the education system into a second date, you know. Hey, what do you think of this? I mean, if I meet somebody new now, I usually just tell them what I do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Be like, yeah, that's a great
your move.
Way to bring it up. Yeah.
You know, might as well put those cards on the table. You want to take one more break and do a little more?
Yeah. Yeah. Game. Yeah.
All
totally.
Right. We'll be right back. This is...